I had a friend, the friend bring me the deal, and then I turned it over to my team and said, put this together. And we structured it in a really brilliant way for them to be able to grow their company. But in doing the documents, they didn't put some of the typical governance pieces in there.
Hello, fellow risk takers, and welcome to my worst investment ever. Stories of loss to keep you winning. In our community, we know that to win in investing, you must take risk, but to win big, you've got to reduce it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm on a mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives, and I want to thank you for joining that mission today. Fellow risk takers, this is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stotz from A Stotz Academy, and I'm here with featured guest, Dr. Thomas Powell. Thomas, are you ready to join the mission?
Absolutely, Andrew. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, so let me introduce you to the audience. Imagine navigating the high-stakes world of capital, strategy, and legacy with a guide who has raised billions in structured ventures worldwide. Dr. Thomas J. Powell, founder of The Powell Perspective, is a seasoned entrepreneur, investor, and advocate for founders, bringing clarity, strategy, and resilience to leaders building at scale. Thomas, take a minute and tell us about the unique value you are bringing to this wonderful world.
You know, Andrew, in my career of which started my first company over 40 years ago, but started investing strategically in companies starting in 92. So it's been, you know, 33, 34 years now. And so what we bring is a unique founder advocacy. And oftentimes our co-investors in deals are also founders that have had exits. So we align capital with clarity, governance, and integrity.
Mm. And as a founder, I mean, how do founders find you? Where is the place that they, you know, where do they find you? Online?
It's been an interesting story because for the most part, people could only find us by introduction. I didn't have a big web presence or anything out there. That was actually part of our underwriting of both our investors and the deals that we looked at was who introduced you to us and kind of the best known secret out of Silicon Valley. Now we actually do have a website. So our family office, which is called the Brehon Group, led a venture now called the Founders Office. So it's Founders-Office, horrible moniker, but founders-office.com. And that's where you find all of the services that we provide to both founders and founder investors, which is groups that we service on this.
And how wide or narrow are your services?
Generally, they're the early stage capital raising. So generally, if a company's 10 million US revenue stream to about 100 million US revenue stream, and they're looking to scale and they're bringing in that next stage of capital. So they're way beyond, you know, friends and family, but they aren't necessarily looking to do an A round. It could be structuring the institutional capital. We could be using unique finance products that we've done worldwide through one of our arms that's very bespoke. So we can do larger deals as well. But we really love those founders that are in that range. They've got an idea, they've proven that they've got a market, and they're able to grow it. They just don't realize that bringing in capital is a full-time job. And as investors, it's oftentimes they've exited a company, they've got, you know, 10, 15, 20, 100 million, more than that sometimes, and they want to go invest. But typically, they're finding the investments, which was them. So they're identifying the founders that was just them, and they don't have any framework of what to do. So they end up either losing a lot of time or a lot of money or both because they don't have a specific investment. And they're just bored of doing institutional investment. So, you know, they're like, that doesn't fit me really well. I want to have more control. So those are the two groups that we really service.
And what is the investor looking for at that stage? So you've got, actually, you've got a few different stakeholders. You've got some original, let's say, angel investors and others, and some of them may say, well, I've had enough of this ride. Can I somehow figure out a way to get out? And others would say, no, I want to continue this. But that's on the original investor side. Now you've got new investors coming in. Are these new investors saying, I want to, you know, be with this company for life, or I want to help them get to the next, or I want to help them list, or I want to help them what? Or I don't want to help them. I just want to put money in and get a return. How does it look there?
It's all across the board, Andrew, because sometimes it is the easiest, but also the worst investor is the one that's, I just want a return, right? And I'm going to get in and get out. And that's generally where we, in a capital alignment model, what we do with the founders and with the investors on both sides, we get them to match what's the problem that's being solved. So one of the books, you've got all your books on the background. The Richest Man in Babylon is one of the books that I just absolutely love. And it's because it's so simple. It says invest in something you know and understand, and then invest with people that know and understand what it is they're doing. So we use the scenario of, do you understand the problem that's being solved? And if you understand the problem that's being solved, and then the solution is relatively simple, even if it's complex, but it can be described, that probably will be a decent investment. Mm-hmm. And somewhere down the line, there's going to be some liquidity event so you can get back out.
And, you know, I'm just curious about it because there's two things I was thinking about. You know, some may say to the founder may go, oh, I can do this myself. As you said, you know, and that's one thing. And then what I was also thinking about is like, what should a founder expect at this point? You know, they're at this level, they're talking to these types of people. So maybe you could just address those two things. I'd be curious to hear what you'd say.
So the founder oftentimes will think, you know, they've had a lot of success in many cases, especially if they've grown a company to $10 million, throwing off cash. They're usually living a lifestyle. They've moved into a space that we name, you know, I'm partial academic. So of course we have to name things. So we've named this the founder's isolation paradox, which is where the founder's grown the company to the point that they have these advisors, usually their C-suite of people. They have these outside counsel, outside accountants. Their spouse probably helped them start the company and their banker. And none of those people in their sphere are actually aligned. So at 2 a.m., the founder is sitting there looking up at the ceiling, still trying to make decisions all on their own because none of them have all of that. So that founder that's gotten to that point also has had a lot of success because a lot of times they deem themselves the smartest person in the room. They've been able to get it going by grit. They've been able to figure out a regulatory problem, whatever it is. But they come up to this barrier, which is now capital starts becoming more sophisticated in most cases, and it's larger dollar amounts. It's not just your mom lending you her credit card to start the company, right? So it's like, how do you grow this and how do you align it so that it actually matches the goals of the company in the short term and in the long term? And does it match the executive team? Does it match the founders? Where do you have to look at that cap table? And all of those pieces come in. And if you go talk to a lawyer, in most cases, they're going to know some of that, but they haven't even actually ever done all those processes themselves. Mm. That's part of where we come in, and we're actually the founder's advocate. And to take a backstory, in 92, as I'm coming out of Silicon Valley in the 80s, working for a large bank, we were seeing more and more founders being kicked out of their companies by the money. And having been an early stage founder myself, I'm like, okay, how do we help coach these founders where they're never generally going to grow into being a professional CEO, but they can find the right way to lead and guide a team and grow that company and get a good exit. And that's been our story since 92.
Interesting. I own a business that's about at the revenue level that you talk about. And with my best friend, Dale, who's been running it, Coffee Works, it's called, for, you know, we've been running it for 30 years. In fact, tomorrow I'll sit down and it's the 10th tomorrow and we'll review the financial statements of the prior month. And we close the books on a monthly basis for 30 years. So we have that part in good shape. But, you know, it's interesting to talk to you about it because it makes me think, yeah, you know, there's another stage of growth that requires first capital, but probably also new thinking. And I think every business ultimately ends up being a one-man show. It's just a question of how long can it survive as a one-man show. And if you want to expand your business to be $100 million in revenue, you know, you can't do that as a one-man show. And so, it's fascinating. I appreciate you sharing your experience on that. So I think for the listeners and the viewers out there, make sure to check out the website. I'll have links in the show notes so you can get there. But now it's time to share your worst investment ever. And since no one goes into their worst investment thinking it will be, tell us a bit about the circumstance leading up to it and then tell us your story.
So it was a fun time. We were just in the midst of actually coming out. So my daughter, who again runs our family office, she's like, oh, Dad, you have to talk about there's a podcast out there where I'm talking to Joe Polish, and it's where I lost $400 million. So, of course, that would be the one we should lead with, but that's not the one. That's not the one that's caused me a lot of my aggravation of why did we do this? And so we have an investment in cannabis. And the backstory on that, whether you're pro or against cannabis, the backstory was my kid's grandmother had gotten breast cancer. And the only thing that really worked with that whole treatment pattern was cannabis. And cannabis was just becoming legal in a couple of states for medical marijuana. Mm-hmm. And we're like, we need to help this get done because this does really seem to, so let's invest in this. So I had a lot of other things going on. I had a friend, which is problem number one, because then we bypass some of the checks and balances that we always use for investments, right? The friend bring me the deal, and then I turned it over to my team and said, put this together. And we structured it in a really brilliant way for them to be able to grow their company. But in doing the documents, they didn't put some of the typical governance pieces in there. And so it's not a huge investment for us. It's about $3.6 million. It's not a small investment, but it's not, you know, it's just an irritating investment because it's a friend that I got to look across the table with all the time. And so part of the challenge was, as it went on and I started taking more time and looking at it, I start bringing in the governance pieces. And I'm like, well, if we haven't caused these governance pieces, the, you know, binding pieces that we look at with this to be done in the covenants, how can we go ask now? Because three, four years.
What does governance pieces mean? I'm not asking you to give out secret details, but just what does governance pieces mean for someone that may not understand that term?
So it's in our documents. We put how often they were going to report their, they provide the general ledger to us.
Yep.
So we could do an external audit on their auditors that they would actually use true GAAP financing regulations, which is hard because cannabis is not regulated under GAAP, right? It doesn't have federal, but it was very important to say, okay, we still need to meet this for our own investment.
Accounting for agriculture is really difficult, particularly intellectual property related to breeding and genetics. It's incredibly complex.
All of that. All of it, right? And then we go through COVID as part of this, right? So all of these scenarios are within there, but we do have the governance in our documents. So again, they're items that say, hey, they need to, at the end of the quarter, they need to provide financials to us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no one checkboxing that because it's one of Tom's personal investments. Then what ends up happening is all the systems and frameworks we put up around everything else. And 3.625 is a big enough investment that it pisses me off. Yeah. So it's like, now I'm wasting time and money getting back in there and steering the ship. And then we get into the second part of this is, you need to have people that are licensed. And I have no desire to get a cannabis license, right? So if we take over the company, we're at a scenario of where do we actually have to find the next cannabis person, which gives you a small market, which when you only have a small exit market, you lower your prospects of how you're going to exit.
Mm-hmm.
It's how to have the leverage of driving this. And again, we did this as a shared appreciation loan, so it wasn't a pure equity deal. But normally we take a seat on the board. We made so many errors. And the main one was, Andrew, we didn't follow our framework. We have a framework. And because it was a friend, we stepped outside of that framework. And then the checks and balances that we have, we didn't feel comfortable doing that again. So the overall arching thing is, we never lend to friends, right? That's a You don't do that. Unless it's the same, but you know, they say good fences make good neighbors, good documents keep good friendships.
Yeah. So what I want to do, I mean, you've said a lot of stuff there. It's a bit repetitive, but I really want to go back and have you summarize the lessons that you learned. 1, 2, 3.
First, verify alignment. We've talked about that earlier. We talked about that even pre-show. What is it in the storytelling? What problem are you solving as the founder and as the investor? What problem are you thinking they're solving? And is there alignment in there? And is there an alignment on what the process is to get capital? No. Now, we can't control COVID. We couldn't control, you know, 9/11, all these things that happen. Markets happen. But if everything's going along the line, are we still aligned of what the deal is? And so one very, very simple test that we use is we use the when will you sell? And so my scenario is, if this business now was worth $25 million, would they sell? And if the founders say no, and we don't have any triggers for that, I'm stuck getting carried along there. And so I taught this to my daughter years ago. I said, every time you get an offer and you don't take it, you just bought it for that price. So if somebody came in and offered us $25 million and we think it's worth $35, but would we pay $25 for it?
So when you're saying, when will we sell, you mean as a outside investor, when would you sell?
Yep.
Okay. All right.
So, so that's the verifying the alignment. The other one is really, really understanding and watching the hubris. And this is difficult and sometimes because we've got a large legal group and a large accounting group and, you know, a bunch of smart people educated all over the world from Harvard to Northeastern, you know, I mean, just strong minds. And so know the legal and the regulatory landscape. And we always say it's, you know, it's like looking around the corner. Can you see around the corner? And who has that insight? Because somebody's been there. And then the last one is really, what are the enforcement mechanisms for accountability? So in the cases of like when we make a loan, and we say your financials are due to us on the end of the third quarter at the last day of the final month. And if you don't have those, you are in a default on the loan. And these are then the points that go down there. And the last one I'd say that works really well outside of the United States is arbitration outside of the United States works really well. Arbitration clauses in the United States are crap. So arbitration, for the most part, in your international, they set up the rules for arbitration before you go into arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
You've already picked, hey, we're going to pick one arbitrator. You're going to pick the other one. They're going to pick the third. We're going to arbitrate it in Spain. We're going to use Spanish law. And you're in Thailand. And we're, you know, we're over here in Germany. And you set up those rules for divorce before you ever do the deal. In the United States, they just say, you'll go to arbitration.
Which is a whole new battle.
Wow.
Yeah. It's interesting because when you're operating globally, you kind of have to figure out, okay, what language?
Yeah.
Oh, what legal structure?
Legal structure?
Yeah. Where do we want to be?
Where do they have their assets? Because if all of your assets are in Thailand and we take you to court in Spain, because that's what we agreed to in Spain, but that doesn't do anything for us in Thailand.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So,
and by the way, it's the same way in the US because we have 50 fiefdoms. And if you're in Nevada and you're in all these other areas and all the assets are in Nevada, but you don't sue them in federal court and you sue them in Wyoming, you can't really easily get to the assets in Nevada.
Yeah. So you mentioned alignment and you talked about watching for
alignment,
hubris.
Legal and regulatory landscape. And what triggers do you have to enforce accountability?
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And one of the things that I was thinking about is, you know, one of the things that I see, particularly with startups, is that they are underpaying themselves. And what happens there is that as an investor, you have to make sure that they're paying themselves market price. And as I tell people, I said, when I give presentations about valuation, they ask me, how do we increase the valuation of our company? I said, double your salary.
Yeah.
And they're like, what? How could doubling our salary do that? Because it would put you in loss. And then you'd realize, holy crap, we're not paying market rates. And therefore, what's going to happen when a buyer comes in is they're going to say, okay, yep, well, we're going to have to double all these. And we have to take into consideration, you know, how would we run this if you weren't there and you're licensed and we're not, and we're going to have to figure that out. And this just reminded me of that. So for the people out there who have a startup or a business, you know, double your salary. That's a big one.
Well, and I think, you know, Andrew, I think that says something really, which we try and do in our founder advocacy is being the employee is a job. That's a salary.
Mm.
Compensation plan for that. Being the founder, being an owner, that's a position that's different. So you and your partner go meet and you go over the books. And if he's working in the shop all the time, he should be getting a salary for doing that. And then separately, you guys are taking out your ownership pieces in that. And if you're bringing some other value that's paid for that time versus exchange of intellect or whatever, that's one deal. And when you can segment that out, you do prepare yourself better for an exit. You also prepare yourself just for better management.
So let's go back in time and think about a young, you know, you in that situation. So let's imagine that person today is, you know, their friend comes up or a deal comes up. So based on what you learned from this story and what you continue to learn, what one action would you recommend that person or our listeners to take to avoid suffering the same fate? Just one action.
Well, again, if we looked at it as that the primary failure was that we didn't align the capital and the exit well from the beginning, and it didn't get documented well. And I'm not talking about 35 pages written by the attorneys. I'm talking about back of the napkin. Here's the 3 points that we need to get to, and we can define those points. That is the most important part. I think it makes for a good marriage. I think it makes for a good investment.
Great. And what's a resource you'd recommend for our listeners?
Well, first, I would say if you haven't read The Richest Man in Babylon, it's like one of the simplest books out there in the world, but it's been around for, you know, a long time. I think it's 1960s it was written, maybe even before that. I read it when I was pretty young. And I just love it that it's like invest in something you know. Don't get caught into. And we've taken that to another step. Invest in a problem you understand that needs to be solved. So you don't have a coffee shop and somebody's going to do a coffee shop there and you know that everybody's on that corner. Great. You understand it. Go do the problem, the cannabis. Various pieces in there. The second one is, we call it the bigger pile theory, or I call it the bigger pile theory, which is take advice from people that have a bigger pile than you. Don't take it from people that don't have a bigger pile than you. So meaning find people that are really know it. Don't just theorize on it, but they know it. They've been there. They hopefully can see around the corner. And the third one is we've got a pace that whether it's a founder. So let's say you and your partner want to raise capital. You can go out to our founders-office website and you can take your pitch deck through and we'll give you a benchmark of where you're strong, where you're weak, and what you should look at, which goes through our investment framework. We also do that for investors. So if you're investing in a private company, even a public company for that matter, but you want to take their pitch deck and run it through our system, we'll tell you where we see it align in a strength and what weaknesses in that area. We don't give investment advice off of it, but we do say these are things you want to look at.
Great advice. Yeah, and we'll have that link in the show notes. By the way, The Richest Man in Babylon was written in 1926.
I knew it was.
It's an oldie.
It's a great book.
Yeah, definitely.
Great book.
All right, last question. What's your number one goal for the next 12 months?
Wow. My wife would say it's about skiing because I ski about 100 days a year. But we've started a founder and founder investor cohort program through the founder's office. Mm. And again, it was my family led to take the intellectual experiences I have of over 40 years and putting it down into a model where people on both sides of the transaction, so we can have a capital alignment. I am a fierce free enterprise saves the world person. I'm dual citizen EU and US. Mm. I work through Asian and other, South America. And I just love our founders no matter where I go in the world. Mm. I good place down in Tanzania not that long ago. And we had all sub-Saharan founders come to our house in Lake Tahoe. Not all of them, but we had a large group come to our house in Lake Tahoe and spend a number of weeks with us. That was fascinating. So I love working with founders. I love working with the founder's capital, the people that have had an exit and are putting the money back in and aligning that capital.
Yeah. Free enterprise, free markets, great stuff. In fact, it's kind of sad where it's gone. I mean, I stand up in front of people now whenever I speak. I literally stand in front of them and I say, I'm a capitalist and profit is my passion. And they're like, oh my God, somebody said it.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
So, I can say it. I lived it. It took me out of poverty. I'm very thankful for that model.
It took us all out of poverty.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, listeners, there you have it. Another story of loss to keep you winning. Remember, I'm on a mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives. As we conclude, Thomas, I want to thank you again for joining our mission. And on behalf of Ace Dots Academy, I hereby award you alumni status for turning your worst investment ever into your best teaching moment. Do you have any parting words for the audience?
You know, I go back to my kids. I have five kids. So when the youngest one, I'd say, learn OPE, other people's experiences. So when you see your sister, or your brother do something really stupid, don't do that. So this is a great opportunity because we don't learn from the wins. We learn from the failures, right? So the OPE is just an amazing way to do it.
And that's the way to reduce risk in your lives. Well, that's a wrap on another great story to help us create, grow, and protect our wealth. Fellow risk takers, let's celebrate that today we added one more person to our mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives. This is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stott, saying that I will see you on the upside.